Hi, I'm Sasha Coca, host of the California Report magazine. Every week, we bring you stories about what connects us in the giant, diverse Golden State. Because what happens in California changes the world.
I love this place. We were once seen as like the place to be, California. The land of milk and honey. That's where you go to Sunshine State. But we just have challenges right now.
KQED's California Report magazine. New episodes drop every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor of The New Yorker and host of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast. On the podcast, I ask a great contemporary writer to select a favorite story from the magazine's almost 100-year archive to read and discuss. Together, we delve into the story, exploring its themes, its style, and what makes fiction work. You can listen to authors like Otessa Moshfegh talk about why we write.
Story, or attaching a story or creating a story, is this inclination that we all have to stop spinning.
And you can hear writers like George Saunders discuss the nature of storytelling.
On the first read, you accept these things as descriptions and they make you see the scene, but every line is a chance to inflect the reader's mind.
You'll discover new favorite authors and read old favorites in new ways. Episodes of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast are released on the first of every month. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Shin Yi. If you're looking for even more Asian American-hosted podcasts specifically about Asian American literature, then I'd recommend checking out the podcast Books and Boba from the Potluck Podcast Collective. Books and Boba is a book club podcast all about books written by Asian and Asian diaspora authors. As someone with a passion for elevating Asian American narratives, I'm happy to see programs like Books and Boba shine a light on authors who bring those stories to life on page. Each month, Books and Boba hosts Marvin Yue and Rira Yu choose a book by an Asian author to read and discuss. Past book club picks include Babel by R.F. Kuang, Front Desk by Kelly Yang, Pachinko by Minjin Lee, and many more. Not to mention the show also features interviews with authors and a monthly review of the latest news from the world of Asian American literature. Today, I'm excited to share one of Books and Boba's interview episodes featuring writer and translator Anton Herr, who was recently revealed to be the lead translator for K-pop megastars BTS's upcoming memoir. In the episode, Anton discusses his work as a Korean to English translator in the publishing industry and his work on the book I Want to Die, But I Want to Eat Tteokbokki by Baek Se-hee. With that said, here's Books and Boba.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
And hey, welcome back to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And on this episode, we have not an author chat, but a translator chat. Our guest is Anton Herr, the English language translator for Baek Se-hee's I Want to Die, But I Want to Eat Tteokbokki. Is it a memoir? It seems like it's like a combination of things.
Yeah, it's a memoir and also a self-help type of book and also a bit of motivation and gives insight into mental health. And it's a very interesting book. Baek Se-hee is a millennial. She's a social media director for a company and she goes to a therapist to get help, get treatment for her dysthymia, which is a persistent depressive disorder. So the book is very interesting because there are like transcripts from her sessions. So it reads like a script. And we talked to Anton about pretty much like what the process was like, because this is our first time talking to a translator. We don't know like how they get the job pretty much and what that job entails other than just translating, because that's a very tricky job. I feel like
There's a lot that goes into translation, and you know, we just read another translated work for our last book club pick, and just so much thought needs to go into not only how to translate this work from one language to another, but how to like maintain the author's voice, because so much of reading is also subjective. And it was really fascinating to hear Anton's very unfiltered opinions and thoughts about the landscape of translating, who gets to translate, and how he's been able to make a career out of translating Korean works. So, yeah, I had a lot of fun. We should do this more often. We should interview some non-author people in the world. I mean, Rira, you've been saying this for a long time, but we really do want to talk to more translators, more publishers. And yeah, I like this new direction that we've embarked on.
Yeah, it's definitely out of our usual comfort zone. But I had a great time talking to Anton, and I hope you guys enjoy our conversation. All right, so we are here with Anton Herr, the winner of a Penn Translates grant and who was long listed twice for the 2022 International Booker Prize for his translations of Bora Chung's Cursed Bunny and Sang-young Park's Love in the Big City. And we are here to talk about his latest translation work, I Want to Die But Eat Tteokbokki, a memoir by Baek Se-hee. Welcome to the show, Anton.
Hi, thank you for having me, Rira.
So, from what I understand, you're not part of the Korean diaspora. You grew up as a third culture kid and have been living in Korea for a number of years. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience as a third culture kid?
Sure. So I did a separate podcast about this recently and discussed it extensively there. But basically, I think a lot of people don't know what a third culture kid is, and I'm sure in this podcast they do. But just for those who don't in the audience, it's basically someone who basically grows up in another country, but they are not trying to assimilate into that country. So they're not part of their first culture, which is where they're born or where their parents are born. They're not part of the second culture where they are physically present or resident. But they're part of a quote-unquote third culture where it's basically its own world with its own rules and kind of its own norms. And it's a very internationalist space. And I think, yes, my father worked for a Korean government concern. He was not a diplomat because TCKs in Korea like make a huge distinction between, oh, your father's a diplomat. Oh, your father is not a diplomat. It's so stupid. And so he worked for a government concern. And I make it sound like he was a spy. He was not. He worked for an economic concern. And I grew up in Sweden, Hong Kong, Ethiopia, Thailand. And I would spend a couple of years in Korea, a couple of years overseas, and then come back to Korea and spend a couple of years in Korea, and then go back overseas. And so it's also that's what's different from growing up, for example, as diaspora immigrant, because normally when you are an immigrant, you move once when you're young or before you're born. And then you stay in that country for however long. So I had I have a very international upbringing, a very bilingual upbringing, because I would attend English language schools and international schools overseas. And but ever since I graduated an international high school in Thailand, I have been living in Korea. I'm 41 now, so I've been living in Korea for like over 30 years now. And I think 21 of those years were continuous. So all of my adult life, I've been Korean and living in Korea.
Wow. So you went to ISB.
I went to ISB. Have you been to
my
ISB?
Cousins went there, actually. One of my cousins probably was there the same time you were, because she's about your age as well. We can probably talk about that afterwards, but that's cool.
Oh my God, that's awesome. Yeah, that's awesome. It's a great school. It's a great school. My husband will never let me forget how, like, we went to Phuket once a couple of years ago, and we were visiting some friends on a very beautiful resort. And then I was looking around and I was like, oh, this place reminds me of ISB. And then my husband's like, what? So he has this idea that I grew up like a princess. And I'm like, okay. Yeah, it was hilarious. Yeah.
Well, I feel like our conversation is pretty timely because our last book club pick was a translated Korean novel. We read The Hole by Haeyong Pyeon, which was translated by Sora Kim Russell. And this is our first time on the show where we are talking to a translator. So can you tell us about how you became a translator and what do you actually do? What does the job entail?
I read this study that was conducted here in Korea on Korean translators and interpreters, well, mostly interpreters. And when the translators were asked this question, they all said the same thing. They said, oh, I became a translator by accident. And what this means is that, I mean, as, you know, as diaspora Asians especially will know, is that when you are growing up bilingual, as many diaspora children do, they tend to become translators and interpreters for their families. And so this is basically what happened to me too. So, my dad speaks excellent English to this day, but my mother, you know, does not. And so I would interpret for my mother. And that very naturally kind of like segued into doing it for, you know, money. Not a lot of money in the beginning, but there's always, always, always a demand for English and Korean interpretation and translation because Korea is a client state of the American Empire. And so as a client state, we need to be able to communicate in our master's language. And so so there's always a demand for English interpreting and translation in Korea. And so I really just like fell into it. My brother works for Samsung. And he, when I was about to graduate college, I asked him, hey, so should I work for Samsung too? And he said, you know, you could be the working for a chaebol. The thing about working for a chaebol is that you can be the king of the rats, but you would still be a rat. And that advice affected me at a visceral level. And so I was like, oh, okay. And then he was like, why don't you just build up, you have a translation practice. Why don't you just build up your client list? Instead of, you know, getting a job at a company. And I said, oh, maybe I'll do that. And so, and that's what I did. And I've never had any other job really out of college. Even during college, I had this job. And ever since I was like, I think the first time I was paid for translation was when I was like 12 or something. So I'm a 41-year-old man who's had the same job since he was 21, like 12, which is very lazy, but what have you.
Yeah, but I wanted to ask, like, you studied writing and literature, correct?
Well, I studied literature. I never studied writing. And again, this is something that the literati kind of like make a whole thing out of. But
literati.
Yeah. But I can't study. I can't study. Well, I could, I guess, go to a creative writing school in Korean here in Korea. But I don't know. It's never really... There are just so many other things that were just like grabbing my attention. And I was much more interested in studying other things that I never studied writing. I did study literature eventually, but I majored in law and double majored in psychology in undergrad. And then I took an open university degree in French. And then I went to grad school in literature, but like at a much later stage of my life when I was like 33 years old, I think. Yeah. So, studying literature came a bit later.
So how did you get into translating like whole books?
Yeah. So literary translation, you can't fall into. It's very deliberate. Well, maybe at some point that you can fall into, like you guys mentioned, Pyeonhyeong's The Hole translated by Sora Kim Russell. So from what I understand, Sora Kim Russell does not go around selling her translations. People give her work. And she's really the last translator to whom this could happen, because all the translators that come after her, we have to go out and get our own work. So if you want to be able to translate a book, then you have to go out and get the rights for the book and then go out and sell the book to a foreign publisher and then promote that and translate that book. And then promote that book. Like you have to do all of these things as a literary translator. And that's basically what I kind of realized around 2018. After my first two books came out, like nothing happened. And so I was like, oh, I have to go out and get my own work. I can't rely on work to continually come to me. I thought once I was out of the valley of death for emerging translators, then I would get more work, but that just was not the case. So I had to learn how to be very proactive and very networky and very pleasant in person, because I'm really not. I'm very unpleasant in person. And so I had to learn how to do all that and be all of that. So yeah, it's very complicated, like the submission process. Translations are sold very differently from the way non-translations are sold in Anglophone publishing. The UK is very different from the US. And there are all these like hidden opportunities that you have to know how to look for. And I had to learn how to do all of that. And now I try to pass this knowledge on as much as possible, because for the most part, no one really bothered teaching me how to do this. And I think it's a shame that, you know, publishing is already so gatekeepy and so opaque that I feel like it needs to be more transparent. You know, we need to be able to pass on this institutionalized knowledge, because ideally we should burn it all down and start over, but that's not going to happen in my lifetime. So this is the next best thing to drive a wedge into the system as much as possible with information.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate you turning on your pleasant voice to talk to us on this podcast. But that's wild. I didn't realize that being a translator involves like essentially running your own like
publishing company. Getting the rights and everything. That's so complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now it's like that. I mean, again, like Sorokin Russell is like, I don't know, like 3-4 years older than me. Like, she's not that much older than me, but really the translators who came in that era, like up to, you know, the noughties even, like they were able to, because there are so few of them, and they would be, you know, foreign agents or foreign publishers, like when they needed a translator, they would go to LTI Korea, and LTI Korea would be like, oh, like, you know, here's Sorokin Russell, and, you know, and then connect them and give them a book. But that really does not happen. And that has never happened to me. Like, the Literary Translation Institute of Korea has never given me a book to translate.
Right. So how do you pick the project you want to do then? Is it just this book is doing pretty well in Korea, let me see if I can get the translation rights too? Like, do you approach the authors, the publishing companies, or how do you choose your projects?
Those are two separate questions. Like, how do I choose and then how do I approach? So how do I choose? It just has to be really, really compelling. I have to, a very good indicator is that if I hear the English immediately upon reading, then I'm like, oh, this is a good match for me, for my translation voice and for my translation brain. I could kind of like see how it can work. So many translators, I feel like they just, I don't know, to them, translation is a very academic exercise. And I feel like that's fine if you're an academic or if you're doing it for school. But if you want to do it as a job, as a profession, then you really have to think about what the reader is going to think and how the reader is going to feel. And I have a lot of faith in my ability as a reader, because that's the number one thing that I'm trained in. Like, I don't really consider myself as a, this is going to sound so weird, but like, I don't really consider myself as a writer or a reader. I, a writer or a translator, I consider myself as a reader. Like, that's my main identity. And I feel like if you ask me, like, what is the one thing that you're really good at? I'd say, oh, I'm good at reading. I'm pretty good at translating, but like, I'm really great at reading. And so, so when I read a book, I get the feeling that, oh, this is why this book, there are these moments where I know this is why this book was written. And I can make it sound like the way it sounds like in English, because I know I have a reading for this book. I can also translate things like Google Translate translates things, like translate them without really understanding it, because I could just, you know, put words in one set of words into another set of words. But, you know, like, readers can tell that, oh, you're BSing right now. Like, readers are not stupid. So
readers can tell if you're using Papago and
yeah. Even if you edit all of that like edit Papago and edit Google Translate, like a good reader will be able to, I mean, even a bad reader would be like, oh, there's something soulless about this. Like you there's something that hasn't been captured here. So you really can't get away with that.
Yeah. I mean, I always wonder when I'm reading translated works, because the really good ones, they read like they aren't translated. And you know how much of that mm-hmm. is, like how much of that is you as a translator kind of translating those like cultural or like colloquialisms, and how much of that is you interpreting the author's intent?
I mean, a really fun game. And so is that, you know, Tomb of Sands, which translated by Daisy Rockwell, written by Gitanjali Shri, and the book that actually won the Booker Prize this year. So that book is kind of like the quintessential example of what you just said. Like if you read that book, it's just so beautifully translated. Like, of course it won. When you read that book, the translation is just so beautiful and so witty and like punny in places. Or like, is this what it sounds like in the Hindi? Like it makes you really curious about the source, because like, how did she pull these like Englishisms out of a completely different language? Like, it's not even a romance language. Like, how does she do it? So, there are books like, I mean, you can just tell if something is like a really good translation, even if you don't read the source language. That's totally like the case. And I think a really good case for that is this year's winner.
So I want to ask, like, since you say that you are a reader first, I'm guessing that you read I Want to Die But Eat Tteokbokki in its entirety in Korean before you, I guess, auditioned for the job.
This book is unusual, because this is one of the like, now that I'm a little more quote unquote famous, like people know who I am, in the publishing world at least, this book was actually like sent to me.
Oh, so nice. Like,
yeah. So that was like a very nice, like, ooh, now I'm a translator kind of moment. And it's happening more frequently now, especially after the whole Booker Prize thing. And so, I'm very grateful to the Booker Prize judges. But yeah, this book was sent to me from, by the English publisher, by the UK publisher, actually. And of course I've read the book, because, you know, it's such a huge bestseller in Korea. And one of the things I studied in college was psychology. So I'm very, very interested in psychological narratives and whatnot. But the problem with this book and why I did not pursue publication was the fact that it was nonfiction. And until really this book, it has to be said, nonfiction was really not something that Anglophone publishers were interested in coming out of Korea. I have published a nonfiction book before this, which is Hwang Seok-yong's memoirs called The Prisoner from Verso Books. But Hwang Seok-yong is a novelist and he writes very novelistically, so we can kind of get away with it. And, you know, Svetlana Alexandrovich, I think she won the Booker Prize or the Nobel Prize or something, maybe both. And so like, so nonfiction writing was kind of slightly on the uptick at the time. And so Hwang Seok-yong's agent managed to sell that book. But I think this is really the first, Korean nonfiction bestseller of its type. Like no Korean nonfiction book in translation has done as well as this book. So for me, I couldn't imagine translating it. Like after I did this one, I was like, oh, maybe is Korean nonfiction like having its time? So like now I have another nonfiction book coming out next year. And I'm trying to pursue, there's this wonderful trauma book on trauma, like from a Lacanian perspective, by a Korean Lacanian psychoanalyst. And it came out after the Sewol disaster here in Korea. And it really helped me process kind of like my grief. And I really want to translate that into English, because there's a lot of grief floating around in the Anglosphere as well because of the pandemic and whatnot. And so, yeah. So we're very excited that a nonfiction book could be this successful.
Yeah. We always talk about, because Rira and I, we've done a lot of work also in the Asian American like entertainment space. It's always like, it takes one, and then all of a sudden there's an example of this in industry now, and now everyone wants to do its one. And we don't know how long, you know, like, for example, Korean nonfiction will be the it thing in publishing, but we applaud everyone who's like getting their work in now, because this is a time when I guess it's top of mind. And, you know, I wonder how much of this is also just like the BTS effect, right? Like something that I don't know which instance of like the Korean wave in America this is, but this is like one of those times, and it's like being spearheaded by like, you know, these dudes who just everything they touch, everyone wants to read or do or see, right?
Absolutely. This book was sold by Namjoon. Like, I did not sell this book. Namjoon was the one who sold this book. Namjoon of BTS, also known as RM. So yeah, it's kind of funny because I have never believed that K-drama or K-pop or K-movies, like, I have never believed that the success in those spheres spills over into literature, because it has never been proven the case. This book is really the first, I Want to Die, But I Want to Eat Tteokbokki by Park Se, translated by me. This book is the first case in which K-pop directly influenced K-literature. And I hate those terms. But not that BTS is K-pop, because, you know, BTS as a whole is so extraordinary that they're actually...
It's a different level.
Yeah, it's like a different... It should be a separate category. It should be like K-drama, K-pop, K-movies, K-literature, BTS. Because they're really operating at a different level. So this is, I think, the first kind of case where synergistically the book, like, it spilled over into the book market. But we really haven't been seeing, in practice, we really haven't been seeing like the rise of Korean literature coming from the rise of, you know, Korean drama, for example, because, you know, the reality is that there may be 10 books translated a year into English, which is, you know, an absurdly low number. I think there are more Netflix dramas that are Korean that come out in a year than there are Korean novels that come out. So we still have a long, long way to go.
I feel like the majority of translated Korean novels that I've seen in the American mainstream literary market are actually written by women, like The Vegetarian by Han Kang and Kim Ji-young, Born 1982 by Cho Nam-ju. So, like, I just want to, like, hear your personal take. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that so many Korean novels and Korean books written by women are doing so well overseas?
This is absolutely the case. So Kyung Suk-shin is also the first and so far only New York Times bestselling author. She's a woman. She also won the Man Asia Literary Prize, which is, of course, everyone knows, is the precursor to the International Booker Prize. So like, Kyung Suk-shin was kind of like joking, like, when she was congratulating me this year, she was like, oh, I wish like you'd been nominated for one of my books. And I'm like, ma'am, you've already won the Booker Prize. Like, why are you even like paying attention to any of this? And like, and she laughed. But yeah, it's definitely women who are like at the forefront, like not only in terms of artistry and, you know, the edgiest books are all written by women in Korea, but also in terms of sales. And I think a large part of it is that, just like it is in the Anglosphere, the majority of readers are women in Korea. I think I read some kind of survey where they determined that the average Korean reader is a woman in her 20s or 30s, college educated, and she reads for about 30 minutes before bed. And so that is like our battleground. And so yeah, not only are, you know, not only are women the people who read books the most, it's also, you know, women writers are just, you know, edgier and much more interesting. And I think it's because women, there's probably a confluence of factors, but if you were to ask me, which you are, then I would say, like, it's of course, like, Korea has like one of the worst gender equality indexes in the OECD. I think the worst, like even worse than Japan, which is saying a lot. It has one of the worst gender, and it has so much gender-based violence. Like, for example, even in supposedly discriminate, like, disasters, like the recent Itaewon disaster, like I think like something like 88 out of 100, the 152 people who died were women. And that is like a disproportionate representation of women like in disasters and like, you know, in deaths. And it's just really not a great place for women to live, frankly. Even I as a man, a cisgender man, can see that. And so I think it kind of like, I don't want to say like adversity creates good literature, but I do want to think that literature is really about like thinking about like, you know, how you fit into your society, because you have to use language, and language is a social tool at the end of the day. And even though you try to be as apolitical as possible, like it creeps in. And so I think like, and Korea has also had like, has a very long tradition of literary women. And like when Hangul was invented, like when our letter system was invented, like another word for Hangul was amkur, which means women's writing. And because like it was a derogatory way of saying like, oh, Hangul is beneath like, you know, the more classical Chinese writing, because, you know, it's for like, you know, people who are not educated. And so women would like write, like pass on like novels to each other by copying novels into Hangul, like by hand, like brush calligraphy. And like they would, and there's a, that's like a whole genre of novels in Korea. So they're like the first webtoons or something, basically. yeah. And so, or web novels, I guess. And yeah, so it's, we have a long tradition, and social conditions make it conducive for the production and for the consumption of literature for women. And of Hangul is just so easy to read. Like Korea has a 99.999% literacy rate or something like that. So yeah, I think it's a confluence of factors that make women so successful in literature.
Yeah, you mentioned social conditions, and I just can't help but think that I Want to Die But Eat Tteokbokki did so well because, you know, it dives into mental health, and it's such a taboo in Korea. And I feel like that's the reason why it resonated with so many Korean women readers, because I don't know, like maybe it's because we have a very repressed culture. And for a lot of women, it's like chama, like endure, and like don't bring shame onto your family. And I just feel like I Want to Die But Eat Tteokbokki was, I don't know, it was just like a conversation starter. Like, it was something new that people hadn't seen before.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for like on the ground, it doesn't really feel like it's that much of a taboo anymore. Like, you know, my dad took Prozac. He may still take Prozac. And like on like, and the kind of like the narrative that we're always being kind of shoved down our throats as Korean translators is that, oh, it's so like, like, you know, oh, arranged marriages. Oh, like Koreans don't talk about mental health. And oh, like there is this, there are no gay people in Korea. Like there's so many like these like, you know, imposed narratives from the white gaze that we are constantly battling. And this book kind of like, for, if anything, it counters it, because Pixie is just so extraordinarily, extraordinarily honest and courageous in writing this book. She does mention that it is kind of, society is reluctant to talk about to talk about mental health issues, but I want to emphasize that she is writing in Korean to a Korean audience and publishing in Korea. She means like within the context of Korea, not within the context of the world. Like, I don't think she knew that this book would be published and translated into 20 languages like when she wrote it. So we have to hold that in context. Like, Korea is not especially more like silent or taboo about mental health than, for example, America is. Like, I don't believe that's the case. I don't think Americans go around talking about mental health and, you know, telling their bosses about, you know, how depressed they were and how many pills they take. Like, I don't think that happens in America either. So I think that's what she means when she talks about it in this book. And it's very, very dangerous to essentialize that into, oh, it's like taboo in Korea, because plenty of people talk, like it's a huge topic in Korea, mental wellness and so on. So we can't really say say that anymore.
I wonder how much that is just also for us, as in terms of like, you know, we and I are both diaspora Asians, like the culture kind of freezes, right? Like, so like how much of us as Asian Americans, our assumptions of the whole man is based on like cultural norms that are 10, 20 years old too, right? Because, you know, for us, I'm not speaking for all Asian Americans, but like for a lot of us, talking about therapy and things like that is tough with our parents because they kind of get stuck in the way that they remember their cultural norms from like a country that they haven't lived in for like 20 years, right?
I totally understand that. On the other side of that though, that's why Korean American food is like so good. Because they understand what Korean food is supposed to taste like before the soul palate is so ruined now. Like, I think if Korean Americans who immigrated at your parents' age, like if they come back to Seoul and they like taste the food, they're like, what happened? Because everything is just so spicy and salty. But if you go to America and, you know, even younger Korean chefs, like the Korean American chefs, like because they learn from their parents, like the Korean food, like the best Korean food in the world is now in America. That's because it's more authentic than it is in Korea, which is a really funny thing to say. And I may get canceled for saying it, but like, you know, but it's the truth. I mean, it's so there. That's kind of like I understand what you mean by that because it does manifest in other ways. Yeah.
Yeah. And also this book came out in 2018 and, you know, Korean society moves very quickly. It's very dynamic. So, I feel like the conversation about mental health has definitely, you know, gotten more spotlight than it used to about even like 5 years ago. But Peck's memoir is written in a very interesting format. It's almost like a script because she transcribed her therapy sessions, which, you know, if I was her therapist or a psychiatrist, I would kind of be mortified because it's like, why are you recording me? Like, this could go wrong in so many ways. But reading this in English, it made me wonder what the tone was in Korean. And I just want to ask you, like, how did you go about capturing the dialogue and making it as accurate as possible to the Korean dialogue?
That's such a great question. And I wish more interviewers just asked this question because they kind of assume that when we translate, like, we don't think about tone or voice at all, but it's actually the only thing we think about. Because once you have the tone down and once you have the voice down, translating the book becomes very easy. Once you kind of triangulate where this should go, then you're like, oh. So what I did was I had just come off translating Love in the Big City, and then I went right into drafting this translation. I was workshopping I Want to Die, But I Want to Eat Tteokbokki with my translation collective, Smoking Tigers. And my very esteemed colleague, Sojae, mononym Sojae, they gave me this really interesting comment about my manuscript. They were like, you know, like the translation is very accurate, quote unquote, and whatnot, but there's something very flip about her tone. And I'm like, oh, what do you mean? It's like, oh, I don't know. She just seems like very ironic and sarcastic and trying to be funny. But I don't think she really is like that in the book. And then I took Sojae's comments to heart. And then I kind of like looked at it again. I was like, oh, like it is kind of, I did make her too funny, basically. And Sojae's theory was that it was because I just came off of Love in the Big City. And that narrator is very, very flip. And it's like, oh, I think your previous work is invading your current work. And apparently this happens to Meryl Streep. Because if you ask Meryl Streep, like, isn't it hard doing all of those accents? Meryl Streep's answer is, oh no, it's not hard doing the accents. It's hard when I'm moving from one job to another and the accents are similar. Like if she does a Danish accent and then she has to do a Swedish accent, like it's hard making that transition. But if it's like, you know, she has to do, God forbid, a Caribbean accent right after doing a Danish accent, then, you know, then it's easier in theory. So, yeah. So for me, it was, I was like, oh, I have to tone down the flipness. I have to make it very, I feel like she's very subdued in the the patient character, I don't think she's ever named, the patient character is very subdued in the book. And the psychiatrist is actually kind of like, let's cut through all the BS. Like, they're very tell it like it is. And, you know, they're very refreshing and shocking even. And so I wanted that contrast and that dynamic. And hopefully that's what I achieved with the book. But yeah, really, with Sehi's writing, though, Sehi is so precise and so clear. And I know that it looks like, you know, she did nothing but transcribe her therapy sessions. But to me, it didn't occur to me when I was reading it. But when I was translating it, I could see like, oh, a lot of editing went into this in order to make things more clear, in order to make things clean. Because, you know, they in the Korean, they talk in an extremely clear and clean way, like in no way that that normal Koreans talk, because I think Koreans are really bad at speaking correct Korean, and Koreans tend to be really bad at writing correct Korean, because you can have an English writer like write perfect English, like a paragraph of perfect English, but no Korean writer can write a paragraph of perfect Korean unless they're a special kind of linguistics professor. And the only people who speak perfect Korean in Korea, in the world, in fact, are television announcers, because they are like trained to death. They're trained like K-pop idols to speak perfect Korean. But most Koreans you meet on the street, even professors, like they don't speak perfect Korean. Like they make mistakes all the time. But there's none of that in this book. It's just very clear. And it's very, I mean, it's because Korean is such a highly regulated language that it's a very normative language. So there is such a thing as correct Korean, whereas it's very prescriptive, whereas English is kind of, it's more like an English dictionary is more descriptive. It's not prescriptive. It's like, oh, this is, you know, how people are spelling things these days. Like, that's the job of a dictionary in English, whereas a dictionary in Korean, it's like, spell it like this, otherwise you're wrong. So it's a very different vibe for both languages. But yeah, that was the tone that I was trying to get. And it was really Sehi that I was kind of like, found a bit tricky with, because I was coming off of a different book. But otherwise, that's my fault, not Pixie's fault.
Did you have an open line with her to talk about the book? Or is it just like, gave you the book, said, translate it now?
Yeah, people always ask me this question about my authors, and they're always like scandalized by the fact that I actually never talk to my authors when I'm working on their books. And it's only when I really, really, really have to ask something that I bother them. I consider it bothering them. And I also feel like it's a bit insulting to the author to be like, oh, I don't understand something in your book. Like, to me, that's something that's very embarrassing to admit. Again, I consider myself an excellent reader, like a very good reader. So for me, if I don't understand something in the reading, then, oh, there's something wrong with me. Like, I'm sure it happens and I've mistranslated things and misread things, but I feel like whatever faults I have as a reader are overwhelmed by whatever positive qualities that I have as a reader and a translator. But technically, like, if I ever had something that I wanted to think about with this book, then I could contact her. But the only issue that came up was, so Korean pronouns, as you know, are not gendered. Like, they're all genderless. And so she talks about like the people that she's going out with in the book. And there are two major people, like one who like she breaks up with, and then the other who she then gets into a relationship with after that breakup. And it's never specified that, you know, they're boyfriends. And so I'm like, oh, why don't we just run with this and go completely genderless when it comes to the... And so I did, and the editor was completely fine with this. And then I think in the copy editing stage or something, like fairly late in the stage, I was like, oh, I just changed everything to boyfriend and him, he, him, because I was like, oh, I don't want to have this conversation with like I don't want this to be like a controversy and just distract from the book. And the editor, God bless her, Emma Herdman, at Bloomsbury UK. So Emma went to, Emma actually emailed, contacted Pexe separately, like, oh, so our translator has this idea that that we should keep the lovers genderless in the book. And it's possible to do. It may be a little distracting in English, but we can do it and we are totally okay with it. What do you think? And Bexay apparently immediately said, oh, let's do that. So, oh, Bexay, like, she's a cool person. We love her. Yay, queer allyship.
So this might be a spicy question, but just like growing up reading, like seeing translated books like on the shelves, usually they're translated by, I guess, like white translators or male translators. And I don't know if that's like still the case now, if like diasporan authors or diasporan translators or third culture translators are getting more of those jobs now. But what are your thoughts on, I guess, not translators who don't share that marginalized background?
Representation in translating, right?
Yeah, representation in translating, yes.
It is very much the case. I don't think anyone really commented on the fact that I was the only non-white translator shortlisted for the Booker Prize. And I think on the long list, there was one other Asian translator and then everyone else was white. I think that was the case. So yeah, it's very unusual, especially in the UK. It's a bit better in America, I feel. But especially in the UK, it's very rare to find a non-white translator in any language. Japanese has a huge problem where I feel like 99% of their translators are white. Korean at least has, you know, Janet Hong, Mi, Sung Ryu, and, you know, Sojae. Like, it has translators who are not white. The other problem, especially with Korean, compared to other Asian diaspora, is that Koreans were not allowed to travel overseas for pleasure until like 1989 or something, I believe. And you had to have a special permit from, it's very Joseon dynasty, but you had to have a special permit from the government to travel outside of Korea, from the Korean government to travel outside of Korea. So it was a huge privilege to live outside of Korea. And I feel like most Korean Americans kind of immigrated in the 80s and 90s. And so those kids that were born overseas haven't managed to grow up yet. And even if you are born in America, like in the 80s and 90s, there really wasn't much of an infrastructure for those kids to lean on to learn the Korean language. And to, like, I mean, I feel like the Chinese have a bigger diaspora and a more diverse diaspora. And they may have more opportunities to pick up the different Chinese languages. But Korean is a bit of a different. I think to this day, there's fewer than 2 million Korean Americans and in Korea. So yeah, it's I think it's a confluence of these factors that kind of made it difficult. But now we have translators of color coming out from in Korean. So that's really, really great. I just remember one of my first jobs out of college was interpreting for this politician. And one of the places we went to was LA. And I remember meeting this Korean American girl who, like, she was working on the LA side of the company. And she was like perfectly bilingual. And it was not just her language skills, but also like just her manners, because, like, you know, we're like, she's young and I was young, and like we're sitting at a separate table, and then they start bringing out the food and they start serving us first, and then she immediately goes, "Oh no, you have to serve that table first." And then I was like, "Oh, so she understands all of the Korean like norms basically." And so at the end of the day, like at the end of our stay in LA, I was like, Gloria, I have to ask you, like, are you Korean? Like, are you like Korean? Did you grow up in Korea? Like, what is your deal? Because you're, and she's like, oh, I immigrated when I was, you know, I was in middle school. So she immigrated a bit later than, and she wasn't born in America, but like, and I remember thinking back then, I was like, wow, so this is what the diaspora is like now. They're like perfectly bicultural, perfectly bilingual. And they're, you know, they're on it, they're smart. And now when you look at, young diaspora, like Gen Z Korean Americans, especially, like, they're very cognizant of anti-colonial issues and anti-imperialism. And like, they're just very smart and so well educated. And, you know, they're very interested in Korean culture and learning the language, because like a lot of people, like diaspora of my generation, they were kind of, there was a bit of self-hating going on, and you know, there were, and also they kind of did not have the access that kids now have. Like, you know, the internet was not as common as back then as now. And when I was growing up, I was always considered extremely unusual because I had this bilingual upbringing. Like third culture kids, Korean third culture kids were an extremely limited community. We all knew each other to the extent that we could, like, we either all knew each other or we knew someone who knew someone. Now it's unthinkable. Now there are plenty of Korean kids growing up overseas who have no intention of immigrating, like Kirogyakba, like the goose father phenomenon. But that started happening like in the late 90s. So that generation is now starting to come of age. And so I predict that the landscape will be very different in the future. And they can no longer say things like, oh, only white people can translate or, you know, write in English or have English that's good enough to do translation or do creative writing. And Asian Americans are like extremely successful when it comes to literature. Like there's so many Asian American writers, especially Korean American writers. I mean, there's so many great, iconic Korean American writers like Teresa Hakjong-cha, like, you know, Alexander Chi. Like there's so many. So they can't say that to us anymore. They can't say that Koreans can't write or Koreans can't win awards. So I think it's really, really, like, I don't want to hear about it anymore. Like, I don't want to hear about like how I'm not fit for this job, because, you know, there's so many great people who look like me who are doing this, who are doing such a better job at this than I am. So yeah, the future is bright.
Well, I think that's a wrap. We've been talking for quite a long time, and I'm sure we could go on forever. But thank you so much for talking with us, Anton. It was really, I feel like I learned so much about translation, which was such a mystery to me up until now. So thank you for sharing your experiences and knowledge.
Yeah. Do you have anything coming up that we should be aware of?
So thank you so much for having me, Rira and Marvin. I do have a bunch of stuff coming up. I have three books being published next year in the Anglosphere. One is I Went to See My Father by Kyung Suk Shin. This is an extremely important novel about the Korean War. Koreans actually don't like talking about the Korean War because of things that South Koreans did in the Korean War.
And yeah.
So Hangang is coming out with a novel on the Korean War as well. I keep forgetting what the English title is going to be. It's like No Goodbyes or something. And that book is also, it's going to be quite impactful because that talks about things that South Koreans did in the Korean War that, you know, we're ashamed of, but we are very reluctant to talk about. So the Korean War and what South Koreans did, like that's going to be a topic I feel. So I Went to See My Father by Kyung Suk Shin is going to come out next year. And also this really fun and very like anti-colonial science fiction book called Counterweight, written by Duna, that is going to come out from Pantheon. And I may be going to Comic-Con San Diego next year to launch it. So I have to think of a costume. I have to think of funding first. I don't know why I'm thinking of a costume first. I'm gay, so costumes are important. And the third book that's coming out next year is poet Lee Sung-bok's Indeterminate Inflorescence. And this is basically a how-to book on how to write poetry. It's written in like, you know, aphorisms. And this is like going to be my next nonfiction book. And I'm very excited about that. I'm hoping Lee Sung-bok will let me translate his poems after this book. So we're hoping that, like, you know, that book will do well. So yeah, those three books. Counterweight by Duna, I Went to See My Father by Kyung Suk Shin, and Indeterminate Inflorescence by Lee Sung-bok.
Awesome. Well, good luck on all your future projects. Congratulations on, you know, the release of this project, I Want to Die By. I also want to eat the bookie. And yeah, thanks for joining us on Books and Boba.
Thank you so much for having me. Oh, I'm also translating Ocean Vuong into Korean.
That's also
coming out next year. Yeah, yeah. So yay, Asian Americans. Yeah, keep writing so that we have things to translate. Thank you so much.
Awesome. And that was Anton Herr, the English language translator for Baekse Hee's I Want to Die, But I Want to Eat Tteokbokki, available now at bookstores everywhere. And yeah, it's a really fun book and a really quick read too. So definitely, if any of that conversation got you interested in the book, please check it out. And definitely also check out some of Anton's other translated works as well.
Yeah, I've heard some great things about Bora Chung's Cursed Bunny. It's really nice that Anton and other translators, they're getting to translate more contemporary works by younger authors in Korea. And it's not just like capital L literature. There's also genre fiction that's coming out from there. So it's, yeah, so I'm just glad that we have more access to that nowadays.
Yeah. Before we go, Rira, can you remind us what our book club pick is for the month of November?
So we are reading Year of the Tiger, An Activist's Life by Alice Wong. Alice Wong is the founder and director of the Disability Visibility Project, and her book is a memoir that gives us a glimpse into her journey as an activist and also the continuing fight for disability justice. So we haven't read a nonfiction title in a while. I think our last one was Good Talk by Mira Jacobs, and that was a graphic memoir. So we are diving back into the field of nonfiction.
Yeah.
And it's actually funny that we're reading this after The Hole, because The Hole features a disabled character.
Yeah, looking forward to discussing this book with you at the end of the month. And to our listeners who have finished the book already and want to share their thoughts, please let us know on our Goodreads forums. As always, we love to hear what you think and include your feedback on our podcast as well. But on that note, thanks again to Anton Herr for speaking with us this episode. And we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Hi there, Shin Yi again. If you enjoy the episode and are inspired to read more books by Asian authors, follow Books and Boba on your favorite listening app. You can also learn more about the podcast at booksandboba.com.
At Soundside, we bring you news and conversation rooted in the Pacific Northwest. Hi, I'm Libby Denkman. I think of my job hosting Soundside as, number one, asking tough questions of powerful people, the questions you, KUOW listeners, want answered. And two, bringing you a daily slice of the fascinating, confounding, and often goofy side of life in Washington State. Join me for Soundside at noon and 8 p.m. on KUOW or anytime on the Soundside podcast.